This episode of The Drunken Odyssey is brought to you by Scribophile, an online community with thousands of serious writers working in every conceivable genre. If you're eager to improve your own work and network with others, Scribophile is for you. Scribophile has educational tutorials, exciting forums, and most importantly, the ability to exchange in-depth critiques with other writers, using a karma system that keeps the exchange fair and equal. What is most exciting to me is that Scribophile allows writers to critique novel chapters, which is not something a writer can be guaranteed to experience in an MFA program. A basic account is free and grants you all the features, but upgrading to a premium account allows you to gain access to posting numerous works at once, requires no additional karma points to enter contests and other special features for only $9 a month or $65 a year. That's a lot less than a Netflix subscription. Listeners of The Drunken Odyssey will receive a 20% discount on top of those already low rates. Check out this week's show notes for details.
Hi, my name is David James Poissant, and I'm going to be reading Chapter 4 from my new novel, Lake Life, out this month from Simon & Schuster. Chapter 4. Diane Maddox exhales. Diane Maddox, who traded Tennessee for Texas. Diane Maddox, whose parents are divorced. Diane Maddox, who married Michael 10 years ago and wouldn't take her husband's name. Diane Maddox, who carries a child inside her. Diane Maddox, who had an abortion in high school and who does not regret that choice, but who is not in favor of making that choice a second time. Diane Maddox, who went to school to be a painter before settling for being a those-who-can't-do-art teacher. Diane Maddox, who wonders whether 33 is too early for a midlife crisis, were women said to have those, and if those meant more than a red motorcycle and the affair to go with it. Diane Maddox, who's been reassessing her infinitesimal place in the cruel and sideways pressing world. Diane Maddox, who likes dangly earrings. Diane Maddox, who has always longed to visit Reykjavik. Diane Maddox, who grew up watching Mad About You and wanted to be Helen Hunt. Diane Maddox, who in eighth grade cried through the Mad About You finale, cried over the fact that Paul and Jamie weren't together anymore. They would give it another try the way Diane's parents gave it another try too many times to count, giving it another try, code for the pain a daughter feels when some mornings dad is there eating Cheerios and some mornings mom says, "I hope that fucker drives that thing off a fucking bridge." Diane Maddox, who is unhappy, but for whom divorce does not feel like an option, whether to prove something to her parents or to Mad About You, she isn't sure. Diane Maddox, who wonders whether things would have gone better had she taken her husband's name, though of course a name can't save you. A name can't save a marriage, can't save a house from sale or a boy from the bottom of a lake. Diane in the ambulance. Diane not crying, keeping calm. Diane, following the paramedic's instructions as the ambulance navigates country roads and the paramedic measures Michael's blood pressure. Diane Maddox, not starling, and it's never too late to change a thing, except sometimes it is, pressing the damp cloth to the head of the man she loves. Or loved. Some days, let's face it, she's not sure. Blood pooling beneath the cloth, the forehead, an awfully vascular area, the paramedic says. Worse than it looks. Which Diane takes to mean looks worse than it is, though she can't be sure. There will be stitches, though she hopes against concussion, against brain injury, against anything permanent, because in all fairness, can the girl who said in sickness and in health still speak for Diane at 33? Say Michael slips into a coma or spends his life in diapers drinking through a straw. Does the Diane who said, "I do love this man enough to wipe his ass another 50 years?" And how to love a man who's made it clear, if not in words, then in scowls and sighs and the way he picks strings from the frayed cuffs of his jeans, that he'd rather her not have their kid. Does she love Michael enough to stay? Does she love herself enough to leave? Diane doesn't know, knows only that Michael's blood is real and warm and won't stop rising from his head. The ambulance breaks, the doors open, and Diane breathes. The hospital is not what she was expecting, small and beige and boxy. The building looks less like a hospital than a bank someone dropped onto an acre in the woods. Gently, she is pushed aside by a nurse at the curb, Michael lowered into a wheelchair and asked to hold the cloth to his own head. Of all the fears Diane has ever known, fear of flying, of snakes, of seeing the sticks minus sign become a plus, never has she known a fear like watching her husband's face paint the water red. The paramedic pushes the wheelchair forward. The nurse holds the door open for Michael to be pushed through, and Diane follows, feeling useless. Inside, the waiting room is empty, the floor a checkerboard. The woman at the front desk is rude, the hallways are hot, the x-ray room is cold. Then Michael is on the table and she is at his side. The betadine goes on and Michael winces, his forehead orange. The needles go in and she has to look away. She holds his hand. The next time she looks, 8 Frankensteinian stitches hold his head together. They fill the gap between eyebrow and hairline, as though Michael's left eyebrow has an eyebrow of its own. Then the x-rays are in, and all is well. Good enough for this country doctor anyway. Though Michael gives Diane a look that says, when we get home, I'm getting a second opinion. Not that they can afford a second opinion, what with a mortgage they can hardly handle on a house that's worth half what they paid in 2007, 4 maxed out credit cards, plus Diane's student loans, which, no matter how hard she ignores them, aren't exactly going anywhere. Still, she's glad to see Michael's talking, smiling. Mostly, though, she's happy she won't have to change his diapers till death do them part. That said, there is a diaper she wouldn't mind changing in fewer than 7 months. This love for a thing unborn, a thing that isn't even yet a thing. How to explain this love to her husband? She promised him she'd never want a child, and she'd meant it at the time. The mistake wasn't getting pregnant. The mistake was making a promise that was never hers to keep. The doctor scrubs his hands. A nurse will be with them shortly to discuss care and cleaning, he says, then dries his hands and leaves. Michael is still on the table, lying down. His eyes are on her middle, as though he can see beyond her waist into her womb. We're keeping it, she wants to say, but doesn't. Not yet. She's not religious, but she is superstitious. It seems bad luck to fight about the pregnancy today, as though doing so might invite the spirit of the dead boy into her, might curse her with a baby born blue-lipped, without breath. If fates are steered by thoughts, by words, the least Diane can do on this day is keep quiet. So she lets her husband hold her hand. She smiles. And there are many, 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 many things she does not say.
Welcome to The Drunken Odyssey with John King, a podcast about the writing life.
Tell us, oh muse, about a man whose mind and career has careened far and wide and upside down, whose computers are seared with crimes against grammar, whose typographical aggressions are legion, whose words flow into the very mouth of time, and more than a few bottles. A man who actually owns a typewriter, and perhaps even a soul.
And now, your host, John King.
Welcome, my friends, to episode 428 of the World's Greatest Writing Podcast. On today's show, I interview my friend David James Passant, whose novel, Lake Life, came out last Tuesday. How are you all doing? I, for one, am getting cranky. My eyes and body and my vehicle are all giving me technical troubles. Florida weather has been, obviously, summery. As in infernal heat interrupted by thunderstorms hurled at us from a deeply angry god. What's that, Sylvia?
Thor is angry. Boom, boom, boom. Thor is angry. We don't care.
Yeah, I try not to care. Two nights ago, I got into the pool here over at the secret headquarters, and I must confess I wanted to turn into a fish. Maybe a swordfish, or a stingray, or maybe a manatee. In an ocean of rum. Speaking of confessions, I called an old acquaintance who gave me such great advice about my latest flash fiction. That flash fiction being the fifth installment of The Confessions of Guy Psycho. Hopefully that's going to get to my editor over at Bachelor Pad magazine soon. Thank you, Paul Britton. Some days I get to feel like a writer. In books news this week, J.K. Rowling has... oh god, just look it up. So it is a privilege for me to be able to talk to all of these writers, share notes with them and with you. If you have questions that you might like to hear Jamie and me reply to in a future episode, please do send those questions in to thedrunkenodyssey@gmail.com. All right, let's get to the interview.
And now, the interview of the day.
Well, this is an exciting moment for so many reasons. One, I am back in the secret headquarters of the Drunken Odyssey for my first in-person interview in a long time. And I am rejoined by my friend, who is a great writer, David James Poisson. He is the author of the celebrated The Heaven of Animals, a wonderful short story collection. And now he's the author of the novel Lake Life, which is a luminous existential portrait of the life of the middle-class American family in the 21st century. It's a powerful book, and despite the fact that it should be so depressing, it's actually a very companionable book, and the pages do turn. So congratulations, Jamie.
Thank you. No, thank you. I appreciate that so much. I know we thought we'd be having this talk in 2015 and then 16 and 17 and 18 and 19. And finally in 2020, I finished the book. So I appreciate your patience.
Well, you know, I won't say I was worried about you because you're better than I am, you know, but I was curious about, yeah, like partly what may have been taking so long. Like I remember at one point you were saying, oh, you know, writing a sex scene, there's so many, it's such a delicate balance to, and I thought, I don't think so, but that's the way I write, you know, like, then again, I don't mind sending plenty of readers going, ew, no, okay, like, that's partly my aesthetic. And then I get to read the book, and I'm like, yeah, no, the sex scene, like, it didn't seem so scandalous that it required that much mental strain, so... yeah, since I think the book is, I think, just an extraordinary, it's a literary book that is a summer read. Oddly, it's a beach book.
Thank you.
If you're...
I was trying to walk that tightrope of it being both, both page-turner and compelling at the sentence level. So if that's what you read, I appreciate that.
Well, it's resonant. You know, the chapters tend to be short, which I think is on purpose. And there are a lot of perspective changes. You have six main characters.
Yeah.
And I actually did the math, and it's actually pretty even.
It was a challenge. I worked really, really hard. The book grew and shrank and grew and shrank. The first draft was 300 pages. The next draft was 200. The third draft was 550. The fourth draft was 400, and then the final is right around 300. So it was like an accordion going in and out as I tried to get a feel of whether I was writing.
Wait, it went from 200 to over 500.
Yeah. I couldn't decide if I was writing.
So that's like a Grady problem, right, in Wonder Boys.
Yeah.
Like the yes. The 200 to over 500 jump.
There were no dental records of horses, but it was I was getting into the weeds on all of their backstories. The novel takes place over 3 days, and at one point it took place over 4 days, and it also a lot of it took place in the past. And when I realized this really needed to move more swiftly and I could stick more to the front story without losing anything, I realized that a lot of what I'd had to write to figure out the characters was just for me, and no reader should have to be subjected to the totality of all of their life experience.
So it sounds like you needed to relearn the iceberg principle.
Absolutely. Sure. Because, you know, I was someone who wrote stories for 15 years, trying to write a first novel, even though I have two bad novels in the drawer. Trying to really write the first novel was a whole new challenge. Absolutely. Yeah. And so a number of things.
Because a backstory is kind of like a short story. And you're like, well, this is a perfectly good, like, yeah, but not for a novel necessarily.
Yeah. You know, chunk by chunk, I didn't regret any of the things I'd written. But in the aggregate, it just got so long and boring, I'm sure, for other readers. fun for me. But yeah, nobody
Well, rather than boring, I would posit that it's probably just asking too much for the reader to strain to remember what the thread of the story is. If, well, you know, 20 years ago,
right,
which might be a blip in a character's thoughts in the present, but if you go back and relive it, then it's hard sometimes to remember where in the chronology you're supposed to be.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. So it was a matter of figuring out what do readers actually need to know about the past of these characters? How much do they need to know about their lives outside of this weekend? I'm fascinated by work in life. And so a lot of the original drafts of the book concerned, you know, Lisa's an ornithologist, Richard's a mathematician, you know, Michael sells shoes, Thad wants to be a poet, Diane's an art teacher, Jake's an artist. And I spent a lot of time talking about how they got into those lines of work. And ultimately, the book didn't need a lot of that.
No, it turns out if he just if Jake just has an agent, we know, oh, he has an agent.
Right.
The agent maybe discovered him, but yeah, like, we know what an agent is. We know what an artist does.
But yeah, no, I thank you too for saying that you found that they were well balanced. That was another trick, was deciding who's going to tell which part of the story over the course of 3 days in what order. And then I also gave myself the challenge of trying to get every character in scene with every other character, which often meant creating lines of tension that weren't in my initial imagination of the story to kind of find a reason to have two characters together.
Yeah, so Michael, the oldest son, who's an alcoholic, and I do take issue with your saying such bad things about alcoholism, but he has 7 scenes. Lisa has 7. Tad has 6. He's the younger brother.
Yeah, who, Dad, yep.
You say he wants to be a poet rather than he is a poet.
Yeah.
Jake, the artist, has 5, which, considering he's such a horrible character, that I think is really surprising. He seems like such a superficial character, and then the longer we stay with a story, the more interesting that gets. Richard, the dad, has 6.5. Diane has 5. Because sometimes, yeah, the characters, like, they'll be the focalizing character, but then we sometimes get a surprising amount of revelation from a character who might be in dialogue with that character.
Yes.
That isn't necessarily the focalizer, but...
Right. It's not their viewpoint, but they talk.
But we still get depth out of them, even if, like, it's not their viewpoint.
Sure, sure.
So, yeah, the formalist in me actually, like, made a chart.
Oh, wow. I love it.
Well, partly a lot of it had to do with Jake, because he seemed like a almost disposable character, the oversexed gay guy who is really successful and really insecure, which is like, okay, you have everything and you're making life more difficult for everybody because you think you don't have enough. Like, fuck off. Like, and of course, I think either you did that on purpose or... the way the rest of the story works out, you did on purpose in order to justify our feelings of resentment and awkwardness around him. So to give some sense of what the book is about, in the first chapter, a boy dies. It's not even in this family.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's a family new to the lake where people go to summer. And it seems like the lake is gentrifying, so that it's probably just now a place where people will actually use summer as a verb.
Yes, exactly.
And a little boy who is, you know, like, not an angel himself. He flips Michael the bird, and then Michael has to go save him. Michael, who hates kids and is an alcoholic, who just wants his drinks and to be left alone.
Yeah.
Like, that's his ideal. It's like, let me just be quiet and be invisible. And if people just let me have that, I would be content.
Yes.
And he's the only one who notices that this idiot little boy is really being not monitored. And it turns out he's got the big floaties on, and he can't swim, and he hurts himself, and he ends up drowning in this lake. So we have this despair of this absolutely tragic, horrible thing that sets the whole story in motion. And the story's not even about that kid's family. It's about this other family. And by comparison, they should be doing great. And no, they're not doing great.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's perfectly well summarized. I, in the beginning of the book, kind of sprang from real life, not from something that happened, but from something that almost happened. When I was on a lake in 2007 or 8, I saw this, and it was actually scarier than it is in the book, because the boat was moving. There was a little boy hanging off the back of the book, like feet in the water, while the boat was speeding at 20 or 25 miles an hour. He looked like well younger than swimming age, and he only had water wings around his arms. And I thought, if he falls off that boat, he is going under, and he's going to drown. And just as I thought that, this police boat pulled out of another cove and pulled them over. And I'm sure they got the world's most expensive boating ticket because it was totally illegal. And most of the people on these southern lakes, they know the boating etiquette, and they would know that not to do that. And that also he should have been wearing a life jacket at that age. So I don't know what that family circumstances were, but it haunted me. And then when I had daughters of my own, I had nightmares for months of them drowning. And I knew it was because of just this thing I saw. It's this thing I almost saw, but then imagined. And it just bothered me enough that I thought, what if he had drowned? And what if I had witnessed this? What would that do to my psyche?
Well, and I don't mean to traumatize you further, but even if you're a very responsible parent,
yes,
like, yeah, you can't keep bad things, you can't keep tragedy necessarily from happening. Like, yeah. You might.
No, yeah. I mean, hundreds of kids drown.
And then there are stupid people.
Yeah.
Who
people drown every year in pools, in lakes, in the ocean. It swimming's dangerous.
Like it happened at Disney World, right? I wrote that essay about it. And, you know, writing that essay, I had to figure out, oh, it's not completely that family's fault. Like there was a sign saying, don't go in there.
Right.
But just spending, I don't know, some hours out in the sun in the summertime in Florida. And then like at the end of the day, you're trying to relax and like, okay, you're not a normally functioning human being at that point. Like,
yeah. And also I think if you're not, I had a lot of compassion for that family. Cause I think if you're not from Florida, you don't realize there really are gators in every body of water in Florida, like how dangerous it really is. I think if they really knew, of course they wouldn't have let their kid in there, but yeah. Yeah, no, it's scary, and kids drown. And so when I first thought of this book, I thought this could be the story of Richard and Lisa losing a child and a drowning, but they had already lost a child. This, you know, this family first appeared in my collection. The thought of doing that again felt not only melodramatic, but just cruel. I couldn't do that to them. So I thought, well, what if this is decades later and it's something they witness that reminds them of the loss of their own child to SIDS and then, you know, recomplicates life.
And, you know, there are a lot of miscarriages that people don't mention, which isn't especially relevant to the story, except to say that there are a whole lot of people walking around with pain.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Like their whole lives that they don't bring up, because if it wasn't public, like making it public doesn't help. But we, you know, share each other's lives. So it's, you know, even as sensitive, right, it's difficult to be the friends that we necessarily would want to be, because we never have enough information.
Yes. Yeah, for sure.
And if you're an alcoholic who's working in a shoe store and it's your job to be the responsible one, it's difficult not to feel a sense of rage and self-righteousness. Mm-hmm. One of the things I've had to deal with in my life is being angry that I'm the responsible one, or I'm the one who knows how to write a business message. Like, I don't care about anything. And I didn't have kids on purpose. And like, how did I get to be the go-to person? Like, I deliberately became the asshole so people wouldn't do that. And one of the things I've had to learn is, well, okay, I'm not as big of an asshole as I wanted to be. And I think some people saw through that, but also
I think your inner teddy bear shines brighter than you realize.
I just find it shocking that people think I'm responsible or that I have wisdom, but maybe I shouldn't. But Michael clearly, I mean, it seems like so many characters in this book are lost. Mm-hmm. And one of the problems for men is when they're lost, they don't even have a language to really discuss how they're lost or you know, what their predicament is, other than, I wish everybody would leave me the fuck alone.
Yeah, no, these are all men who don't know how to share their feelings, except for Thad. I think they're all very bad at communicating. Those are kind of the characters I'm attracted to. I love all these, you know, some readers have loved these characters, others have found them, you know, quote unquote unlikable, which isn't a word I ever like to apply to fiction. But I have so much sympathy for all of them, and especially, yeah, Jake and Richard and Michael, because they are hurting and acting out in unhealthy ways instead of talking to the people they love and talking through their issues.
Well, I think Jake is a wonderful example because he begins in such a hateful way or in just such a selfish, narcissistic way that it's, you know, and like he kind of has everything and he's kind of the least satisfied person, even though he seems the least affected that this boy died.
Yeah.
And his relationship is kind of with Tad is on the rocks, which eventually he's aware of. And the whole family, like the parents, like their marriage is on the rocks. And it seems like nobody knows that, including Richard.
Yeah.
Who is the husband.
Yeah.
He's like, no, she doesn't know about the affair. It's like, no, she knows about the affair.
Yeah. Yeah.
You're not that bright.
Yeah. He's oblivious for sure.
And so, you know, yeah, the reason I think why you're suspicious or aggravated by the term unlikable character is because people are giving themselves permission to write a story off if they, I mean, it's related to the word relatable. Like, mm-hmm. I personally don't approve of this person's behavior to a point where I don't approve of a story that will include them. Therefore, I'm checking out. Right. When, in fact, sometimes those are the best characters because they cause the most trouble. And if Jake was allowed to be two-dimensional throughout the whole thing, then that would be a problem.
Yeah, it's an age-old quandary. I was having a conversation with a student last semester. We had read this wonderful story called All Through the House by Christopher Koch from his first collection. It's just a brilliant story. I mean, it's like his The Things They Carried. It was anthologized everywhere in all the Best American and Best American Mystery, and it's been in anthologies, and he was named one of those Granta 20 Under 40, I think just on the strength of the story alone. And it's a beautiful portrait of a man who winds up killing his whole family, but it works its way backward to this scene of him in childhood, and you really come to love this boy and feel so bad for how things went for him that would turn him into this monster. And I remember talking to the student about the story, which to me is one of the most beautiful stories I've ever read. And the student said, you know, I can't like a person who would do this, so I can't like this story. As though to enjoy the story would be somehow like a have some be condoning his murder.
It would make you complicit in the logic.
And I was sad for that student. I thought, you know, you're going to miss out on so much great literature if you limit yourself to only enjoying works about characters in which nobody does anything you wouldn't do.
Just go ahead and skip Flannery O'Connor.
Right, sure. or most writers. So I don't know. I don't know what that, I guess that's not my ideal reader. But for me, you know, certainly there are monsters in fiction. But you've got to be able to, I think as a writer, you have to offer compassion to most of your characters and at least find a way to see them as human.
Well, I think a project like the story you mentioned, which I confess I've not read. Well, I think it's, you know, so many writers feel like they have to pretend to have read everything. And it's like, well, I've read so much. I can actually cop to what I haven't read yet.
I've been listening to your podcast for 9 years. I don't think anyone would accuse you of being underread, John.
So... Well, you know, like the problem is if someone isn't going to be on my show, it's hard for me to make the time to read them now because I do a show every week. The point being, kind of like watching The Wild Bunch implicates you. And if you really get into the violence, what does that say about you? And there are no good characters in The Wild Bunch, right? That's the message of the movie. Like in the beginning, you see kids pushing a scorpion into a red ant pile, and then the red ants just swarm all over the scorpion and start killing the scorpion, and you're like, those are the kids in this messed up world. But it's not completely unrelated to the world we live in.
Sure.
And the world that America grew out of.
Yeah.
And so you're kind of warned right early on, like, if you can't handle the moral pressure of living in this imaginatively, then you better get out now.
Yeah.
And I think for, you know, some readers, you know, they don't have a comfort level to sit with that sort of moral ambiguity to even ask the question. And I do think it's kind of casual morality saying, oh, well, if we had treated the psychopath better, like maybe the murders wouldn't have happened.
Which is definitely not what the story is saying. No.
But I do think knowing of such a project, like that's a fear I think readers are going to have is they're going to be asked that question. And while I may be a little bit cynical and certainly, you know, skeptical, you know, I feel comfortable enough to to sit with that question, especially if it's a well-written story.
Yeah.
And of course, one of your strategies is you've got six characters so that if one of them bothers us too much, like, okay, we get to take the pressure off there and then we move over here.
Yeah, that's good advice. Just to tell the reader, if you don't like someone, wait five pages. The point of view shifts.
Well, I think that some of the characters might make, you know, readers uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Like, I like Naked Lunch. I like the Toilet of the Soul literature. And not that your work is like that. It's not. But what I'm saying is, yeah, like, what is completely comfortable for me, like, some readers might, you know, if they're just expecting, I don't know, a very bougie novel that is going to be very intellectual and not have any rough edges and not have any real despair in it. Well, okay, this book isn't for you.
Yeah.
But, you know, for a book that's full of despair, like, this is an awfully damn good book. And it's a page turner. And, you know, you manage to make the story go in a lot of different places, but it's always moving. And, you know, the characterization seems to drive the story forward pretty well, which is tricky, especially when you have so many moving parts, which maybe that's why it took a while, is having these characters and trying to figure out, okay, like, I imagine you had, you know, a chart on the wall, like a detective, like, okay, these two are here. And then on day three, they're over here.
Yeah. I had lots of notebooks. I had three notebooks, one just devoted to the characters. Like, so all their backstories, all their character traits, all the kind of, little motifs that'll pop up again. Like, you know, Lisa will have a lot of bird metaphors. That'll have a lot of underwater kind of, imagery. Things like that. And I had another one devoted to all the places around Christopher, North Carolina, which is based on Lake Toxaway. Highlands is a real town. The way I describe it is real. I went back to Highlands and took a lot of photographs. And I actually got my first letter from someone who read it, who grew up in Highlands, North Carolina, which is amazing anybody did. It's a tiny, tiny town. And she was like, I know the ice cream store that used to be there. I was like, yeah, that was a real place with the trout and the stream and all of it. You know, Asheville, the waterfall there, all those things, the hospital, all those places are based on true places all around, you know, southwestern North Carolina. And
say that again.
Yeah. The southwestern corner of North Carolina. if you hit Georgia, you've gone about 20 miles too far. So yeah, one notebook was for characters. One was for places that I wanted to get somehow jammed into the book. And then another for just all the different plot lines and the threads and the relationships between, you know, siblings, between parent-child relationships, the in-laws, spouses, all these different. And I was juggling more lines, plot lines at one point, but I had to let some things go. So, yeah, just trying to decide the order of who spoke for how long, in what place, in what order, over whether it was going to be over 3 days or 4 days. It was such a complicated process. And then I also made the mistake, I've been working on this, an essay about this for Lit Hub. I made the mistake of believing I could write a timely novel. And I've come to the conclusion that there are timely novels, but I think it's only by chance that you kind of jump into the zeitgeist at the right moment. If you try to do it, you will fail every time. You know, this novel started in some ways as my argument for gay marriage. And then that argument became completely unnecessary when happily it was legalized in 2015. And then I really wanted to deal in the political conversations in the family with Obama versus McCain and Obama versus Romney, which became terribly uninteresting when we had this president become president. And then I had to talk about that. So I kept changing the book to get more and more of the moment until I realized it was never going to happen. And I just needed to set the novel firmly in 2018. And then, of course, by the time the book comes out tomorrow, it's whenever this is airing, you know, it comes out July 7th. Now we're in a pandemic and we have this great civil rights movement that's long overdue. And of course, the book feels irrelevant again. But if nothing else, if not timely, I hope I've given a snapshot of what life was like in the first half of the Trump administration when we knew things were getting worse, but not how much worse and in what ways they would be getting worse as we moved into 2019 and 2020.
Well, I think the political chapter when, you know, the family And, you know, this is the evil thing about family vacations. You spend enough time and you start actually revealing yourselves to each other, and sure. You can't hide behind tradition and nostalgia. And eventually it's like, okay, what?
Yeah, you can only throw horseshoes and play croquet for so long before you want to know why your brother voted for Trump.
Yep, yep. There's only so many card games. Yeah. And so, right, they start getting upset about Trump. And then Michael reveals, oh, like he's conservative Republican, you know, like the black sheep of the family in that regard. And he's like, oh, yeah, I voted for Trump. And you actually gave him legitimate reasons for voting for Trump. I doubt most conservatives are that clear-eyed about their thirst for vengeance and wanting to blow up a rotten system. Like, not, oh, he will fix it, but of course he's not going to fix it, but everyone deserves to be as miserable as I am, seems to be.
Yeah, and you know, I learned so much over the last 3 years. I've gotten really interested in playwriting. I've seen a number of plays, and I've read easily 100 plays over the last 3 years. And what I love that I see recent plays doing better than novels is having these wonderful conversations and dialogue, of course, but also when one character's talking, you feel totally on their side, and then the other character starts talking, and then you're completely buy into what they're saying. August Wilson does this really well in Radio Golf, a play I read last year, where he has a character making an argument for gentrification that you know Wilson is against, and you know the play's kind of thesis is against, but when he gives voice to that character, he almost convinces you out of Wilson's own position.
And it's not a straw man argument.
No, yeah, and I read Wilson's interview yesterday, and I read it when I taught the play, and he was talking about how important it was to give him, you know, the strongest case he could. And I see a lot of players doing that. Lucas Nath does it amazingly well in Dawson's Part 2, and when he's talking about gender, and the Christians when he's talking about religion, and Hillary Clinton when he's talking about politics. So, I mean, I thought, if I'm going to do Michael right, I don't want to give the caricature of an unintelligent, uninformed Republican. I want to present a fiscal conservative who's misguided but knows his facts and does call his liberal family out on certain things. And that was the only way I could do it that would be interesting to me, because a takedown would just be easy.
And if he's just a dumb MAGA person,
yeah.
Like, it's all right, if this character is redeemed, then it would be the redemption of some other him than the one that he's revealing himself to be. Also, Jake is the one who saves that scene. And I think that was the moment when I'm like, I kind of like Jake, because he knew he was going to take a hit. He kind of doesn't, it's odd, like he needs to be worshipped, but he doesn't give a shit about what this family thinks about him.
Yeah. Well, yeah, because, you know, coming out of the background he comes out of, with an abusive family who sent him into this
gay conversion.
Yeah, conversion therapy camp with an abusive father. He distrusts family. So, you know, it's going to be a long time before he can let anyone in, let alone another, you know, set of parental figures.
Yeah, so he has a confession to make that's actually going to trump Michael's bombshell. But what's really juicy about it, you know, is like, he knows this is going to be a bombshell, and he knows that the way everyone in this family is politically wired, that his statement is really just going to unsettle, like he's going to take the floor out of the whole thing. And he's savoring the moment before he's going to do it. And yet the reason why he's going to do it isn't because he cares or doesn't care, but because it's actually the kindest thing to do for this family. Even though he's not letting them in, he could sort of release the pressure from themselves.
Yeah.
In that moment. And okay, partly he's a dick, and like, he's going to take pleasure in, you know, like sharing the one piece of satanic information he can. But, you know, for me, that was kind of the beginning of Jake's salvation as a character. Is, all right, he's an asshole, but it's more complicated than just he's only selfish. And he proved he has a lot of insight when he does pay attention.
Yes. Yeah. I think that's really well put. He he has a lot to offer if he could just stop thinking about himself for 2 seconds. Yeah.
Which happens from time to time.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. What about the sex scenes? or the sex scene that required so much hand-wringing? Was there like a much different version?
There was a longer version. It got shortened down some. So yeah, Jake and Thad are in an open relationship and they find themselves in it. But this open relationship, like a lot of open relationships, has ground rules, one of which is that they would never be involved with someone's ex. And they find themselves with Jake's ex and his new girlfriend, which is a shock to Thad because he had always assumed his ex, Marco, was gay. And now Marco refuses any sort of labels. He's not interested in saying how he identifies anymore, which is a totally appropriate choice for people. But the fact that it bothers Jake is interesting. And he doesn't like that. And so he's somehow wanting...
competition is a woman?
Yeah. So he wants to invalidate that. And he wants Marco to himself. But he also wants Thad to be okay with this. And Thad is not okay with it. And so it sort of devolves into this kind of orgy back at Marco's apartment. And that took a long time to write. Not because I was uncomfortable with the sex at all. Because just more that I wanted to make sure... I got this right, did it respectfully. You know, I don't identify as gay, so writing a gay sex scene, I wanted to make sure I wasn't writing it in any sort of way that seemed like I there was no judgment being passed. You know, I think the only...
You didn't want it to seem especially exploitive or inauthentic.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. So luckily I had a lot of readers there to help me and guide me along. So, yeah.
And it became a lot shorter.
Yeah, and I shortened it down.
Which is how I came to the conclusion, like, okay, why was this a...
You know, I think in any book or story, a little sex goes a long way. So, yeah, I think, you know, it was longer and it shortened down. And I think it's more powerful in the shortening, for sure.
Because it focused more on the sort of psychodynamics of the situation?
I don't know. I think it just got into just kind of a overwhelming series of descriptions. I think about, oh God, what was that novel? Glamorama by Bret Easton Ellis. I think about that book as kind of being an example of what I don't want to do, which is not that I would ever call it pornography, but there is this kind of pornography of description where it just feels like in service to the reality of the scene, you know, there would be moments that would go on for pages and pages with the descriptions of every act. And I don't think we need that kind of photorealism to get the point across of what's being done. Does that make sense?
Why are you sure it wasn't pornographic?
The Ellis book?
Yeah.
I don't know. I haven't read that book in 15 years. If I went back and read it again, maybe that would be my verdict. I'm not sure. But no, I mean, I definitely remember it being erotic, but I also just remember it in scenes feeling relentless. So yeah, I didn't want this to be the kind of book where people thought I wrote it for shock value. We didn't need a relentlessness of just pages and pages of sex to get the point across.
Well, also there's a panic attack in there.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So like before you even get to coitus interruptus, it's like, just interrupt us. Like, this was a bad idea. Okay. Why did people make me do this? Oh, it was all my idea. Oh, damn it.
Yeah.
You know, I think that was another moment, you know, where I felt for Jake, even though, yeah, he's a shithead and this is all his fault. And yet this is what he thought he wanted.
Yeah.
You know, like he thought he could game this to where, you know, he would get what he wanted and he would feel as loved as he needed without giving as much as he would need to give. And turns out he was getting nothing he wanted. And there might be straight sex in there, which was like, oh, no.
Yeah, it's the lesson Jake has to keep learning. Like getting what he wants isn't always going to make him happy. He still hasn't, you know, he's had shows, he's had riches.
Getting what you want will prove, oh, that's not what I wanted.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, I can't compete with a straight woman because I just, okay, what's happening now? You also have to write about art and the art world, mm-hmm. and the value. I don't mean the price tag value, but the cultural or aesthetic value of art, which I think is a really tricky thing to do in fiction. Mm-hmm. Like, I think it's one of the first move beginning writers make. It's like, okay, you're a jerk if you write about writing. You don't write writer characters. We know it's you. Yeah. Stop worshiping yourself. Get out of your own, you know, like get out of your own butt. Just go writes, and it's like, okay, there's an artist. And you're like, okay, I know. All right. So this isn't a writer, right? This is a graphic artist. So as, you know, I think it takes a while to be able to write about art in a way in which you aren't trying to service your own ego and sense of accomplishment as someone working in a different art form than in the graphic arts.
Yeah, absolutely. I always get suspicious of novels that want to tell me about a novelist.
Is it going to be funny?
Yeah. One of these days then I think of the movie Sideways, which is one of my favorite movies of all time and does it perfectly. But I kept resisting Thad being a poet, and I don't know why he insisted on being a poet, because I knew he was going to be someone who was kind of freeloading off of Jake. He wasn't going to have a job. He was going to spend most of his time, you know, thinking about his own mental health. But then I feel like he had to have some kind of drive. And I thought about myself when I was young and lost and I wanted to be a poet. And I was like, oh, that's perfect. Like, he can be a probably not very good poet. And I would throw in just enough authenticating details to give us the sense that, yeah, he's had some success in very small magazines, but he's by no means a genius, you know, the way Jake is clearly a genius. And then I had to do a lot of research into the artwork, because I love art. I love painting myself. I'm not a great painter. I'm a decent cartoonist. But I spent a lot of time reading about the contemporary art world and making sure that, you know, down to like where he would live and how much a painting would sell for. And I combed through a bunch of different like Times and New Yorker reviews of shows to pick the exact adjectives that Jake got in his reviews, because I wanted to make sure it was clear. Like, and even then I felt like...
They sound like parody, but no, this is straight from the newspaper.
Exactly what it would sound like if this hot shit young painter was out of Bushwick was getting reviewed this way. This is what the art world looks like, as near as I could tell, and with some suggestions from friends in New York as well. But then I felt like I needed one more scene, and that for me came toward the end. And again, my desire to get all these characters in conversation with each other, I forced myself to put Diane and Jake into a scene. And so Diane is Michael's wife, Jake is Thad's partner, and I thought these two have nothing to do with each other, seemingly. At the same time, she's an elementary...
Other than they're kind of in-laws, although Jake hasn't married.
Yeah, but they're basically in-laws for all intents and purposes. What's interesting about them is, one, that they're the only two that are choosing to be there. They could leave at any time. They're not part of this family. They're marrying into it. And two, she's an art teacher who would love to have half of Jake's fame and his ability, and she's just recognizing that she doesn't have it. What would it look like in a scene with them? And so I put them together on the dock with her painting and him helping her. And believe it or not, the scene that really helped me think about that scene was when, if you've seen the film of The Devil Wears Prada with Meryl Streep, and she comes in and you've got this young...
This will be a shock, but I haven't seen that one.
Okay. All right. It's actually a pretty decent film. And I think it's Anne Hathaway's character comes in and she's wearing this, what seems like a very nice, simple blue dress, kind of elegant. Meryl Streep's character comes in and... Anne Hathaway's character is kind of rolling her eyes at this world of Vogue and fashion and saying like, oh, you know, it's just, well, whatever you choose is going to be famous. And Meryl Streep gives this 2 or 3 minute monologue where she basically tells Anne Hathaway what she's wearing, why she's wearing it, and it reveals so much about how much there is to know about this world. And I found out later that was a scene that Meryl Streep demanded be written for her character later, because she wanted to prove that this wasn't just some monstrous, powerful magazine editor whose whims dictate everything, that there is a logic and a fierce intelligence behind all this that kind of drives it. And I needed to give Jake a scene where he is not mansplaining, but like coaching Diane in a way she's asking for on her painting. You realize like, he's not just lucky. He truly is this talented painter, because I didn't want him to come off the way Thad did. You know, he really has it, whereas Thad is kind of a wannabe artist still. Does that make sense?
Yeah. And, you know, that was such a touching scene because, you know, she's painting and she's thinking, which is kind of a mistake. And when Jake comes along, you know, not only is she hungry for any of his fame, but hungry for his attention as an artist. Like, they're both artists, technically.
Yeah, and he's never given her any validation. Never asked her about her art.
He's not that kind of a person.
No.
And part of me might think he's a jerk. And then there's the part of me that, like, as a Generation Xer, I'm very sparing with my praise, I think. Like, I have to remind myself, tell my students when they're doing good, not just this was adequate, keep moving. But I have to tell them when they're doing good because, you know, I have my own workmanlike expectations. Like, I don't want someone at every turn to be telling me I'm doing good. I want people telling me write more, like keep generating.
Yeah. Oh, I have the exact same issue. The first time I taught a grad class, no, not a grad class, an undergrad creative writing class back in Arizona, one of my students at the end of the semester, I asked how she'd like the class, and she said, great. She said, the only problem was you didn't like anything. I was like, what do you mean? And she was like, you didn't like any stories. I was like, no. I was like, I loved most of them. She's like, but you only talked about the bad stuff. And I was like, oh, well, I just sort of thought they'd take it as a given. Like, yeah, these are all great. You're all doing your best. Now let's just not waste time on that. And let's cut right to the chase because I know you all want to fix these because that was what I need as an artist. But then I realized very quickly, no, these are, you know, young 18, 19, 20-year-old writers. They need to also be encouraged and pointed out what they're doing well. And so that changed the way I teach. But yeah, that is also my default. I'm like, give me the harshest criticism you can because I want to grow faster.
It's like, I know I belong here. I don't want to just belong here. I want to belong in the bookshelves. Like, come on. Like, yeah, feed me. Make me great. Tell me what I need to do to become great, not just pretty good, not just what it's okay.
Yeah.
Adequate's garbage. Like, and so, you know, Jake, and he actually, I think he asked for permission, like, to contribute to the painting, and then it becomes his painting. But the way you describe it, she notices him, and it's like, by doing almost nothing, he had already kind of created such an interesting idea visually and just created like a whole dusking landscape with just a couple of lines and just a little bit. And it's like, meanwhile, she was like working really hard to accomplish almost nothing. And she just realized, oh, like he has so much skill that I don't even know what he did.
Yes.
Like I don't even begin to understand what it is that he did. And it took him no time at all.
Yeah. And that scene was not hard for me to write because I just, from her point of view, that's how I felt early on as a writer. You know, mm-hmm. I would be writing stories. I knew they were terrible. I didn't know why. And then I would read Laurie Moore or George Saunders or Edward P. Jones, and I would just be like, how are they doing this? Like, these stories are perfect. Of course, I wasn't seeing the rough drafts and all the many revisions they went through because it takes a while to realize that real writing is revision. But when you see how your beginning work pales in comparison to the masters, it's you have to just be patient with yourself and realize you're just going to have to give yourself your Gladwell 10,000 hours before if you're going to have any chance of approaching what these other people are doing.
And 9,000 of those hours need to be editing.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
I think when it comes to writing like a well-crafted sentence, less is more.
Mm-hmm.
Like that's, I think new writers, they're like, okay, let me get the right adjective and okay, now we're going to have the right adverb. And it's like, no, what you're being is indecisive.
Yes.
You know, when you do that. Yeah. So if that adjective saves you a paragraph, go ahead.
Yeah.
Is it going to save you a paragraph? Okay. Then it's slowing your writing down. Why do you want to slow your writing down? Do you want to slow your writing down? Maybe you do, but I think it takes a lot of practice to gain the kind of confidence in the first go around to not keep fussing and struggling to make moves and then making them sloppily with all of these extraneous movements rather than like, what's the point?
Yeah. Yeah. And also to just get comfortable with cutting things. You know, I often, when I'm writing, I'll think of a couple metaphors for something and I'll stick them in. And then later, you know, my editor will be like, these are both great. Pick one. I don't care which, but you can't have both. It's like, of course, yeah. If they're both doing the same work, now I'm just, you know, patting myself on the back by showing that I could think of two things this is like.
You could do theme and variations. Congratulations. Yeah. Now stop.
Yeah.
So in some ways, it's you are doing exactly what those new writers are doing. You're just doing it better. In describing painting in that way is kind of using a metaphor. I mean, you probably did the research on the painting too to make it seem like it's legit for painting, but
yes, I hope so. Yeah. you know, I haven't had a ton of painters read it, but, you know, again, did my best.
So what do you think of the painting in the secret headquarters? I think it's
So
the wheat in front of the ocean. It's very beige.
It's definitely what Jake would call hotel art.
It's beige on beige.
Yeah. Oh, no, it's not wheat. It's sea oats. I think those are supposed to be sea oats on the beach. Because, yeah, there's definitely like some waves going on in the background. There's a horizon with clouds at dusk or dawn. It's hard to tell. It is the sunset Diane would have painted if Jake hadn't.
But the wheat is actually kind of exceeding the frame it's given itself.
Oh yeah, we're breaking this.
It's getting meta there. Yeah, very classic. I didn't pick the art, by the way, dear listeners. So you're a master short story writer.
Oh, thank you.
Well, that's just a fact. You know, you submit a lot, you publish a lot, like you just. And this is the thing, like whenever I might want to get jealous and angry at you for publishing yet again or receiving more, it's like, but I know how hard you work. Like I know, like you are putting in the, it's not like, like behold how great, it's like you're like, I did a new thing because I wrote a new thing. And it's like, you know, like it's the natural result of one, your talent, but also your effort. And writing a novel, a much different thing. So what are some of the things that you learned, you know, working on a novel rather than short stories, which were, you know, your the thing that you know that you're a master of, and then you have to go into this other arena and maybe pick up some different tools.
Absolutely. No, they felt like very different art forms. I thought I could write a novel by thinking of the chapters as just short stories, and that doesn't work because you definitely need, you know, a backbone. Every character needs an arc, and then the novel itself needs an arc.
If you get really lucky, it might work.
Yeah, you know, and there are these books that are, you know, novels and stories, but for this project, thinking that way did not help me, so I had to stop.
Also, those don't read great usually.
Some, I don't know. There's some I love. Others, I think, well, that's a collection. That's not a novel. That's just a collection.
The one I'm thinking of, Alyssa Chappell's Use Me, didn't really feel like a story collection or a novel. It felt like a fever dream that had some good stuff in it, but ultimately didn't feel like a book to me.
I love her stuff. I'll go back and read that one. Yeah.
I think she's a solid writer. Like it's not me saying, she's just
right. No shots fired.
You know, like I think she personally is great. And as a writer, like she's strong, like even as a book that didn't stick with me, there are parts that were great.
I'll have to go check that out. Yeah. So with Lake Life, I think that the hardest thing was, since it wasn't a story, it was learning to keep things in my head. I think one of the things I've gotten good at over 15 years of writing stories is I'm able to juggle a lot of different balls while I'm writing. I can keep a lot up in the air. I can remember when I get to page 25 of a draft of a story, you know, every word choice I've used throughout. I won't repeat, you know, a phrasing or a redundant image or a word choice, and I'll remember all the little breadcrumbs I've dropped along the way, and I'll be able to tie them up if I want to into a neat bow, or, you know, choose to leave certain things ambiguous. But with a novel, once you get past, you know, page 90, 100, it's so hard to even remember, like, what did my characters look like? What were they worrying about on page 2? I remember in a later draft, one of my editors pointed out that I had used the word pinwheel 3 times in the novel, which horrified me. None of them, there was no actual pinwheel, not as a noun, but as like stars pinwheeling. And
I didn't remember the first time. What?
Yeah. I was like, so yeah, like leaning on the same, at like how many times are you going to mention the moon kind of thing? Because you forget that you have. So it's a matter of.
I could see it now. You in the moonlight.
Yes.
You wear a necktie, so I'll know which one's you.
Yeah. And so, yeah, it becomes this thing of trying to remember. Also, with 6 point of view characters, trying to craft their voices, what finally helped me is I got, instead of trying to revise the book chronologically, I started revising the book by character, so that then I was able to see, okay, I'm going to work on Michael's arc, I'm going to work on Thad's arc, I'm going to work on Richard's arc. That way I could stay in their voice for the weeks that I was revising that, because I did want them to each come across with a different point of view. Some of them are more claustrophobic, some are more open and airy, but I didn't want them to all sound too much like one another. So after kind of revising for voice through each character's point of view, then I was able to go back and revise the novel chronologically. And then the last major thing we did was, you know, the novel is broken up into four parts, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, and Sunday night. And Sunday night was a mess, honestly, when my editor got it at the end. And his biggest advice...
Was it because you were exhausted and trying to...
Not exhausted as much as I was trying to end every single...
Yeah, trying to tie it all together.
Yeah, tie it all together in each different character's point of view. And he gave me the idea. He said, instead of having Sunday night be like 8 chapters, it could be 4, because instead of giving Dad a chapter with his mom and Michael...
It's on my chart.
Yeah, Michael another chapter with his mom, and then he's like... Get all these basically three of the chapters were able to be combined into that penultimate chapter, chapter 39, where just the family sits down. And he said, you know, I love my editor because he said, I'm not going to tell you how to do it. He said, because I know you wouldn't want me to. He said, just somehow get Diane and Jake out of there, put them down on the dock, and just have Michael and Thad and their parents sit at the dinner table. Because, you know, the first part ends at dinner, the second part ends at dinner. There's already a natural need for like this final dinner table scene. It doesn't have to be dinner. They could all end at this table after the hospital visit, after they've all reconvened. It's like, but I think that penultimate chapter needs to be just the family talking through their shit. And instead of giving each son a chapter with each parent, they can all four be in scene together, and the comics can come out and the photos can come out and all these things that they've wanted to say. They can all four be forced into... And that chapter took a long time to get right. But when I got chapter 39 right, that's when...
Because
you
needed
a
new voice.
What's that?
You needed a new voice.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's when I realized, like, okay, the novel works. But it was getting that chapter right is what saved the book, I think. Yeah.
So, yeah, chapter 39, family. It's in my chart.
Oh, awesome. Yep.
So I imagine that you also... started reading plays in order to focus on voice more,
yeah,
to lean into voices and to make sure that even though these people are in some ways very similar, in some ways they're so alienated from each other that they have their own, you know, like it's like this half and half thing where they're half in and half out.
Yeah.
And kind of every relationship in this family is on the bubble.
Yeah.
Whether they know it or not.
Yeah, I wanted this to feel like the weekend where any one of these relationships could disintegrate, you know, if things don't go right. And plays also didn't just help me with the voices and with the dialogue, but plays are great at just putting two or three characters in conversation. And a lot of these chapters are just characters sitting around talking to each other. And so plays were a good model of what that could look like.
They're immediate and vivid.
Yeah.
Can't fuck around with a play.
Yeah. Yeah.
So what were some of the plays that, you know, were really informative for you?
I mean,
mentioned
August,
Wilson.
Yeah. August Osage County, Tracy Letts is just a family sitting around arguing at dinners. That was very informative. But yeah, the ones that were the Annie Baker too. Oh my God. I love Annie Baker's plays. The Flick is incredible. Oh, and Itamar Moses, especially The Four of Us, which is a play about a writer and a playwright. That was really fun thinking about that as I was writing about this poet and this painter, one of whom is having more success than the other. But yeah, Lucas Nath, his work, I saw Doll's House Part 2 in the summer of 2017 on Broadway with Chris Cooper and Laurie Metcalf. And I mean...
They're pretty good.
To say transcendent is just an understatement. It was an epiphany. I mean, if my life were a movie, that would be one of the epiphanies. It's watching those actors deliver those lines. It was life-changing. And I went and I read The Christians, which is his play about faith, and then Hillary and Clinton about politics, and Red Speedo, which is about sports and doping. And God, you know, each of the characters is just truly given their due. I mean, they're all, every character has a clear point of view, and they're all arguing as hard as they can for how they see the world. And when one of them is talking, you totally see the world through their eyes. And then the other one starts arguing and you're on their side. And I loved that you just feel like you're pinballed. And by the end, you realize for most of these arguments, there are no two sides. There are, you know, a zillion sides, mm-hmm. and everything is gray, and everything is more nuanced than we allow in our current news cycle. And I really wanted some of that to come through, especially in the politics kind of conversations.
And ultimately, it's not about politics.
Right. Yeah. All the political conversations are a code for the power structures in the family itself.
Well, it's a way of revealing your vision of reality.
Yeah.
And yeah, plenty of us have visions of reality that are not compatible. Like, oh, I can't even see your reality from my reality.
Yeah. And a lot of the conversations are really about, you know, who deserves our compassion? You know, who is deserving of empathy? How do we live in a world? What do we owe each other? You know, how do you live in a way that is moral? I think is really at the heart. And that's what, you know, Lisa and Richard keep coming back to in this game they play, which is a game my wife and I actually play called Smart, Happy, Good, because it seems like, you know, you want, we started playing this after our kids were born, because you want your kids to be smart. You want them to be happy, you know, to have a fulfilling life, and you want them to be good, by which I don't mean good in like a Sunday school sense, but you want them to be, you know, contribute to the kind of the social justice of the world around them. And it's interesting to see how few people can check all three boxes in their life. At the end of their life, say, yeah, I was wise, and I did good for the world, and I enjoyed it. And it's like, can you live a life where all three of those are realized? I don't know. It's a game I kind of like to play, kind of a mind game.
Well, when I spent my 3 years in New York, I think the first year, or most of the first year, I didn't go to the theater. And my friend Kevin Crawford, the Shakespearean actor, you know, like we were talking on the phone and he's like, what is wrong with you? What the hell is wrong with you? And it's like, you know, I'm working a couple of jobs, you know, trying to make ends meet. And I've got this degree I'm working on. And he's like, you can, for like $40, you can get a rush ticket
yeah.
and go see almost any show in the theater district, in the theater capital of this country, maybe of the world. What are you doing? And yeah, after that, like, okay, I was going to the theater every month. And I think the first one I saw was Patrick Stewart in Macbeth. And oh, so wow. I got to call up Kevin and he's like, did you see any theater? I'm like, I saw Patrick Stewart in Macbeth. And he goes, how was it? I'm like, you know, it was pretty good if you're into that sort of thing. He's like, you fucker. You fucker. But yeah. It was shocking how many transformative experiences you could have just casually. All right, well, like, what are we going to see tonight? You know, I got yeah. to see Brian Dennehy in Desire Under the Elms, and this would be scary now, but he began by dragging this giant rock across the stage and delivering this monologue in which the froth from his mouth, because he's like really, really, you
sure.
know, making sure it hits the back row, you know, but the froth from his speech like landed on me in the front row because we had rush tickets for like the previews. And it's like, yeah, no, we're in the front row.
No, yeah, and yeah, I couldn't agree more. I mean, outside of, you know, 5 or 10 Broadway musicals a year, these, you know, it sounds like such a privileged thing to say, but it really is affordable. Like when we saw Dawson's Part 2, we got those tickets the morning of for $30 a piece, and they were terrible seats. But on Broadway, there's really no terrible seat. Like even if you're in the back
row.
The
theaters are small.
Yeah, the theaters are really small. I grew up in Atlanta. And
if it's not Phantom or Lion King, the theater is going to be small.
Yeah, I was used to seeing shows at the Fabulous Fox Theater on Ponce, and so I thought all theaters were huge. And when I went to Broadway, I realized like, oh, most of these theaters are like a fifth the size of what I grew up with. So there's not a bad seat.
This space was designed 150 years ago.
Yeah, yeah. So yeah, $30 seats. Easy, attainable. Yeah. I mean, getting to New York is the expensive part, obviously.
Yeah. But, you know, the theatrical experience, like reading novels is great. Partly if you're working on a novel and then you're trying to write a novel, you're like, if I see anything good, I'm going to want to steal it. And so I'm kind of like, okay, got to put up walls around that. And so theater just feels safer. But it also, I think it challenges you. You're like, I want my writing to be this vivid, damn it. Like, even though you can't make a real person pop up in someone else's actual reading experience, you want it to feel that vivid, that explosive. At least that's how I felt.
Yeah. And I read a lot of novels in preparing to kind of write the novel. But then when I was working on the novel, I read very few because I was so afraid of that anxiety of influence. I read a lot more stories, poetry, plays, and nonfiction. And I especially couldn't read anything that was in the third-person present tense, because immediately I would just feel like that was the voice of my book and I was going to to somehow accidentally internalize something and then steal it.
Or internalize something and ruin what you wrote.
But. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, no, there were several things I put down during that time. I've still yet to read Don DeLillo's Underworld. I picked it up and I read that first opening 70 pages at Pafko at the Wall. And I was like, I put it down and I was like, I can't finish this novel until mine is done because I will never be this good. Like it was one of the most remarkable opening sections of any book I've ever read. And I was immediately not even envious. I was like, this is so far beyond what I can do. I don't need to feel jealousy, just pure, true admiration for this piece of art. But I can't read it right now.
Because part of you wants to compete.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, 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 yeah. Yeah, no, there's more than a little bit of the worst parts of Jake in me. When I'm at my least healthy, I am just this relentless person who wants to be the best. And I have to be careful and keep that in check.
Because being the best includes not wanting to be the best.
Yeah, yeah. Right.
Among other things, you need the humility to actually be able to see.
I'll be the most humble. No, because
nobody's as humble as me, motherfuckers.
Yeah. No, because also, you know, I could write more and maybe better, but at the expense of time with family, time with my children, time with friends. You know, you could give all your time to writing, but then, you know, you pay the price. There's just only so many hours in the day.
And what is it like having a full family life and writing a novel over many years about this family life that is absolutely collapsing in really excruciating ways?
You know, that wasn't the challenge for me. My marriage is solid. I adore my children. They're 10, so they haven't yet had the opportunity to make the kind of life choices that that are permanent, where I'll have to worry about them. So I don't think I've gotten to the hard part yet of being a father. Everything so far has felt really, really blessed and lucky. But yeah, I think I do tend to write toward my worst fears. And so I know that marriages can be fragile. I know that children die. And so, you know, exploring those is almost, it feels like at times sort of a superstitious way of keeping those at bay. Like maybe if I acknowledge these, they won't happen to me. I do think there's something to be said for that. Maybe being part of what's going on in my subconscious, like write it
or at least
get it away from me.
Your subconscious fears from ballooning out without any real definition, but weighing on you anyway.
Yeah. Yeah.
But does it make you more grateful? Like, this isn't like my book. Okay. I could just.
Oh yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Appreciate this. Like, this isn't just an average day. This is a miraculous day.
Yeah.
Which every average day should be, probably.
Yeah, it's always a reminder not to take what I have for granted. But yeah, it is hard. There were days. Obviously, this isn't unique to me at all. I think most writers would say this, but you know, days when you're writing really hard and you sink so deep into the novel, it's, you know, like you're a method actor. It can be really hard to climb back out of that hole and to sit there through dinner trying to have a conversation with people when you're still in your head. There were a lot of dinners I'm sure I ruined because I was just not there. I was still with the boy on the back of that boat or still, you know, with Jake having a panic attack on the floor of his ex-boyfriend's bathroom. And it could be so hard to climb out of that, especially really in the, I think the toughest was all of 2019, kind of in the run-up to getting to the first pass proofs, just revising again and again and again. I didn't feel like myself for, you know, at least 6 months. I was just living in the book, and I'm just beyond lucky to have an incredibly supportive partner who can let me live that way when I need to for my art. She's special. And I mean that in the most sincere way possible. Yeah.
Because it requires such concentration.
Yeah.
To be able to. Can you talk a little bit about just getting to that point of concentration? Because I think in some ways that's the difference between, right, the novice writer and the expert writer is partly it's being afraid to use your materials or fussing over the materials rather than just finding a point and trying to stamp it out. Mm-hmm. Which is why I think sometimes people who start writing in middle age often get right to the good stuff because they don't feel a need to fuss with it. It's like, no, okay, here's my story. And they get that it's going to work out. But, you know, I find myself struggling to find enough of me to put into my work in the first place to be able to do what I need to do. And I think that's a problem for a lot of writers. So can you talk a little bit about just trying to find that concentration to dig down and focus?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's, and this is not anything unique to me either. I think so much of it is finding ways to avoid distraction. And again, I know this also is a really privileged thing to say, but I was able to make my school schedule such that I was teaching in the afternoons and at nights, which left me most weekdays from about 9 a.m. after I dropped my girls off to school till 3 p.m. when I picked them up, to give myself 6 uninterrupted hours a day to write. And it was very important to me that I not check my email before I do that. So my friends know if I'm writing hard, if they email me, they will not hear from me until usually the afternoon, or sometimes for a few days, because I know if I start answering emails, it puts my brain in a different like writing mode, a different voice. If I start checking Twitter or Instagram or Facebook, all these social medias, which I don't think are totally evil, but they definitely have the ability to distract in a way that nothing else does, just because they're composed of language. I have to just move from sleep to coffee into that dream space of writing in an uninterrupted way. And email and social media are the things that will knock me out of the fastest. I know some writers who are able to take a break every hour and check email and then go right back to writing. That I've never been able to do that. I need total distraction free. And I will work with whatever time I have, but I do best with large blocks of time, because I usually find it takes me up to an hour to get into the voice. And then once I get there, I want to ride that wave as long as I can. And usually I can ride it for 5 or 6 hours. At the end, when I was really polishing the thing, I would work for 6 hours, get the girls, spend time with my family. And then when everyone went to bed around 9, I would then do it again from about 9 to about 3 a.m. And then, so I was on a pretty fixed schedule of
like a monster.
Yeah. Of like 6 hours of writing, 6 hours of family, 6 hours of writing, 6 hours of sleep. And by the end, I felt not quite human, but the book improved so much just in a matter of months, because I was giving it half of my day every day, and it can't help but get better unless you're really, I'm sure you could get to the point where you're just overworking it and that'll come across in the page. But if you're still, I was still enjoying it, and I'd fallen back in love with it, and I was just completely immersed. And I wanted every, you know, sentence to work and every word to count. So getting back into that complete distraction-free space to me is really, that's the most essential thing. Yeah, and I know it's a hard thing to do, and I know a lot of writers don't have that luxury to be able to give that many hours over.
I find myself struggling to get to what I call the beginning of my day, and it might be like 3 o'clock.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's like, okay, I've done all kinds of sorry errands and chores. Yeah. And now I get to do the thing I don't want to do, so that by 1 a.m. I might be able to do the thing I want. I'm like, okay, just... And then I think, I'm going to die someday, and that's okay. But what I'm remembering from what you're telling me is it's really important, let's say 2 hours, if I could say, okay,
yeah,
fuck everything. The first 2 hours are mine.
Yeah.
Even if I'm not human, like in those first 2 hours, because the first hour may just be not doing anything other than thinking. Mm-hmm. Like it may take a while to be able to find the beginning of that concentration, but it's important then to have that second hour where you can go, okay, let's see if, all right, you wrote a sentence. Okay, now let's try the next sentence rather, but it may take that long to kind of thaw or, you know, settle into it.
Yeah, for sure. And sometimes, every once in a while, if I found myself at a loss for words, for the ability to somehow like render the English language on the page, I would read a story or read a poem, and usually something would just kickstart that. Like, oh, I love that turn of phrase. I love that line. Okay, I understand language again. Now I can jump back onto my book.
So let's talk about X-Men.
Sure. I would love to. They were one of the most formative parts of my literary upbringing.
So you're younger than me.
Yeah.
And I think that may have something to do with your attachment to the X-Men. So what years were the glory years for you?
For me, the glory... Yeah, and this was hard too, because Thad is so much younger than me that his glory X-Men were different than my own. I had to do more research. Mine... So I jumped on board when I was in middle school. So this was the beginning of the very end of Claremont. Jim Lee came on, and for you know, decades it had just been Uncanny X-Men, and then Jim Lee helped to relaunch, you know, this whole new series X-Men. So now there were two flagship titles and a red or a gold team and a blue team. I think New Mutants had kind of morphed under Rob Liefeld's direction into X-Force. Peter David was writing this comic X-Factor, which was the original X-Men team with Cyclops and Jean and Beast and Iceman and Angel. So that's kind of where I jumped on board, was and through this glorious heyday of the 90s. And the flagship title, Uncanny, was being written by Scott Lobdell. And those were my X-Men. And I loved them until the very late 90s, early 2000s, when Grant Morrison took over. And that was where there was a real turn from me. But during that time also, I went back and I have all the back issues back to, I think, 120. So I've read a lot of Claremont's run. I don't think I've read any of Stan Lee and Jack Kirby's run, but I've read most of Claremont's original run on X-Men in back issues, yeah.
And so what was so appealing?
I think...
I mean, they were the hot comic at
the
time.
Yeah, they were the hot comic, but also, you know, what I loved, So I grew up a very resistant reader. It drove my mom crazy because she was a librarian. She loved to read. She was constantly trying to...
So it was a personal failure for her.
Exactly, yeah. And she kept trying to get me hooked. And she tried everything from like Louis L'Amour Westerns to sci-fi.
Just read something,
adventure.
Jamie.
Yeah. But she knew I loved to draw. And so she tricked me with comics. The Batman movie came out when I was in middle school.
Oh,
you didn't like the original Michael Keaton?
Nope.
Okay. I loved it as like an 11-year-old boy. That was the first PG-13 movie I ever saw. You know, I loved Jack Nicholson as the Joker. So I got into Batman and Robin. And that was when the third Robin was coming along, Tim Drake, Robin number 3. And then I just got into X-Men, I think because they were so visible. But the reason I clicked with X-Men was, you know, I was your typical dorky, chubby, bullied elementary, middle school kid. Nothing particularly interesting about my origin story. But I think, like a lot of kids, I loved the X-Men because they were misunderstood, because they were trying to be heroic, but everyone hated them. I could not identify with Superman or Captain America, like these perfect, shiny, strong, beloved people that everyone worshipped.
And the X-Men looked kind of goofy.
Yeah,
a lot
X-Men,
of times.
They did
like,
look
there's
goofy.
There's the Beast.
Yeah.
Who's just this hairy blue guy. And you're like, who wants to be the hairy, like... I could imagine myself wanting to be the Hulk, but the Beast, it's like,
yeah,
he's got prehensile feet.
Cyclops is doomed to wear glasses forever, you know, and they have to be red for some reason because that keeps the optic rays in.
Like Kitty Pryde is cute, but then there's like Nightcrawler, and you're like, he's just really weird.
He looks like a devil. Professor X is disabled in a wheelchair. You know, it was awesome. It was like all these very relatable characters and. You know, and they were misunderstood. And of course, every teenager wants to feel like they're secretly great, but misunderstood. So it was perfect for me. And then I know plenty of LGBTQ readers who love the series because it's such a not even subtle metaphor for, you know, at puberty, like they get their powers, you know, they're misunderstood for their sexuality and hated for who they become at puberty. Like, so yeah, I think it was a great book for a lot of readers, for a lot of different reasons. So yeah, so it was fun to give that. My mom did not throw out my comic collection as Thad's mother does. I still have all my X books, but that was always the fear. Like you read all the stories about the mother who throws out her kids' comic books. So I had that happen to Thad. And then it was fun to kind of go back and read the issues he would have read and see the runs that he would have fallen in love with.
Creates the danger of additional backstory.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah, there was originally a lot more about the X-Men that was just unnecessary. I did still have to find a way, though, to take my little dig at Grant Morrison, because even though he's a fantastic writer, I did not like what he did to my X-Men. And I particularly did not like his choice for how he dealt with Magneto. So that found its way onto the page.
Well, the confounding thing about comic book stories, even if we're going to say, no, this is close to literature, this is great stuff, or maybe it's not literature, but this is a great art on its own terms, it never stops, which means at some point, like, there's no timetable that works. And then when people start describing different timelines, I'm like, I think I'm done.
Yeah. Yeah. I think comic books need to be, you know, less about the soap opera than they should be. Like, you know, I was able to enjoy Baz Luhrmann's Great Gatsby when I decided I'm going to watch this as Baz Luhrmann's interpretation of Great Gatsby. Like, it's not going to be the real Fitzgerald Gatsby, but it's going to be the way he would do it, you know. And if you've seen Moulin Rouge, you're like, okay, I like it this way. But when you have a book like The X-Men that's been going on for decades, and it's supposed to have something called continuity, and you realize...
Right. Well, it goes back to the 60s, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And it's being
that's
written...
That's like 50 years.
Yeah.
Well, 60.
Yeah.
60 years.
But yeah, all the characters have aged like 3 years. So
yeah.
It doesn't... The continuity never holds up. And then every time a new writer gets on board, you realize they have all their own ideas. And then they resurrect characters who are dead. They bring in characters who... who, you know, other writers aren't going to want to use later.
I want this Easter egg.
Yeah. But if you just are able to say, like, okay, I'm going to enjoy Matt Fraction's run on the X-Men and not worry too much about the continuity problems, then you're more able to enjoy it. Yeah, the other problem the X-Men have, too, is because they are so beholden to sort of writing by editorial committee and trying to match what's popular in the moment. You'll get these weird runs where, like, Twilight was popular, so suddenly Jubilee is a vampire for some reason that they'll later have to, like, retcon out when they're tired of drawing Jubilee with fangs. Like,
well, they're also such a popular item that as a corporation, something has to be done with them at all times, even if there are no ideas.
Yeah.
You know, which is kind of how we get, I don't know, Captain America being an agent of Hydra. It's like, let's throw everything against the wall because we have to try and make money off everything, and we need to try every idea, no matter how slender or antithetical it might be to people caring.
Yeah. Yeah. Wolverine is on every team. Somehow he's Avenger and an X-Man and an X-Force. Yeah. Yeah, like Cap is going to let Wolverine on the team. Like, it's ridiculous. Yeah, as long as you don't disembody the people in front of me, we're okay.
Yeah, yeah. So this is the first time I'm seeing the hardcover, which looks a little bit different than the ARC I got since the... the spine is black on this, which makes it look, I don't know, like a weird penguin book from like the 1980s. So what do you make of the design? Because it, you know, it almost looks scarier than the book actually is. But I love the big font and the white and the green, you know, lettering. So can you talk a little bit about, because that's, you know, I'm sure they ask your opinion, but you don't get a vote. I'm guessing that's how it works.
No, yeah, it was... So the first time around, in the first book, on the Heaven of Animals, that cover went through a lot of redesigns. They kept sending me covers, and I didn't like them, and I was worried that I was being too picky, but my editor also didn't like them, and we finally settled on sort of my second favorite version of the cover we went with, and I was really happy with it. This time around, the second they sent me the cover, I was completely in love with it. It was designed by Rodrigo Corral. He's done so many incredible covers, like The Fault in Our Stars, A Million Little Pieces. You know, like whether you like the books or not, those covers.
It does look like it could be an art film poster.
Yeah, it's like he just has this eye for these truly iconic covers that just you remember. And, you know, the book opens with a boy in the water, and it ends with a shot of the night sky through a telescope. And so... it took me a minute to realize that the boy's face on the cover is composed of a night sky with the ears, the moon, and the Milky Way is kind of creating the eye socket. And I love the subtlety of that, and I love the bright green. I was a little anxious about, you know, my name taking up like a fourth of the cover, but everyone at SNS really liked it, and I was great with it.
That concerned part of you, that wasn't the part that wants to compete and be
right.
The best,
no, I was right? Like, does this look like I asked for this? Like, I didn't ask for my name to be so much, so big on the book. But yeah, and then they toned down the green from kind of the brighter green to the more neon green, which helped it pop with the kind of black and white or sepia cover. But yeah, no, I love the cover. I love the design. And then I really like the way on the back that they went with the green and the black lettering. Because I think on the arc, what is it? They've got, yeah, the blurbs are kind of in these green boxes.
It looks like an awkward PDF on the back.
Yeah. It looks like it was kind of designed in
for the arc.
In Microsoft Paint or something.
But the arc doesn't count.
Right. Yeah. So the full design as it wound up on the book, I couldn't be happier with. So I feel really lucky to have gotten such a great designer.
So the first time you're like, yep, got it.
Yeah. I mean, after so much hand-wringing on the first book, I was ready to dislike it on the second. But the second it popped up in my inbox and I opened it, I was just like, holy crap, that's the book. Like, that's it. That somehow embodies the feel and the mood of what I was going for.
Well, that is the show for this week. I would like to thank David James Poissant, Alexander Pate, and Scribophile. Don't forget to check out thedrunkenodyssey.com throughout the week for all kinds of great written content. And if you would like to support the show, please do leave a review over on Apple Podcasts. And leave comments on the content over at thedrunkenodyssey.com. All right, everybody, until next week, put your ass in the chair, keep attacking those keys, and don't swallow the worm. Stay safe out there.
The Drunken Odyssey with John King, a podcast about the writing life, is a supernova, an interstellar jamboree of colors and lights, like the twirling dresses of a troupe of champion folk dancers, like being imprisoned inside Ace Frehley's amp, throbbing like the veins in Jehovah's hard-on. You can look, but you can't touch, and also, you can't look, because if you do, you will turn to stone, and your guts will turn to marble.
Dear listeners, writers, and fellow Odysseans, send your questions, observations, complaints, manifestos, transcriptions of Turkish opera, and whatever else you got to thedrunkenodyssey@gmail.com.
A while back, John King endowed the Museum of Schlock and tasked me, Jeff Schuster, with curating the bugger. Each week, I curate one more entry into this proud genre of film. I think... Truth is, I'm really not sure what schlock is, but my writing about it is sublime. Read it every Friday at thedrunkenodyssey.com.
Thank you for listening to The Drunken Odyssey with John King, a podcast about the writing life. This is your announcer, Lauren Butler.